Today is April 29, 2008, at independent bookstore Changing Hands in Tempe, Arizona. Award-winning journalist Amy Goodman, host of Daily Grassroots Global and Radio TV News Hour Democracy Now!, is on a national speaking tour to mark Democracy Now!'s 12th anniversary and launch her third book with journalist David Goodman entitled Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times.
Before I introduce our guest, I'd like to let you know that, and this is with Amy Goodman's okay, The Body of War, which is Phil Donahue's movie, will be showing on Thursday, May 8th. It is a story about Thomas, 25, who was paralyzed from a bullet to his spine, wounded after serving in Iraq for less than a week. So Phil Donahue has done this movie. It is showing at the Harkins Theater, let's see, is that true? Chandler Cinema, sorry. And there are a few flyers here, and we'll keep one up here. It's $10 at the door, 7 o'clock Thursday, May 8th. And our guest today is Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, author of the new book, Standing Up to the Madness. With her brother David Goodman, who is an award-winning independent investigative journalist, and they travel the country to detail the ways in which grassroots activists have taken politics out of the hands of the politicians. Standing Up to the Madness tells the stories of everyday citizens who have challenged the government and prevailed, and those who wield the greatest power in America, the everyday people who take a chance and stand up for what they believe in. It also offers advice to those who want to help. Amy Goodman has won many of the most prestigious awards in journalism, including the George Polk Award, the Alfred I. DuPont Columbian University Award, and the Robert F. Kennedy Prize for International Reporting. Before Amy speaks, Dennis Moynihan, the Outreach Director for Democracy Now!, will say a few words. He starts next week as CEO of Free Speech TV.
Oh, wow.
It's a commercial-free television station. And currently it's going to be on Dish Network, channel 9415. He'll tell you more, Dennis Moynihan.
Thank you. Thank you for having Amy here. We're on the tail end of about a three-week book tour. It's kind of described as being on a small raft within Hurricane Amy. It's really... We have our new video producer, Tamar Snohani Massoud, making, I think, a mockumentary, some kind of like the, you know, the film Final Tap, where he's actually catching me in as many embarrassing moments as he can with his video camera. But we're trying to document the hard work that Amy does every day and the tremendous community participation in independent media, independent bookstores like Changing Hands. Around the country. There is a very vital independent media movement. As Pina said, I'm moving to, from about 7 years at Democracy Now! To Free Speech TV. Free Speech TV is a non-commercial channel that carries Democracy Now! 4 times a day to about 15 million homes via satellite and about another 15 million homes on cable. It's carried that way to through affiliation with Access Tucson, for example. 4 times a day, the cable subscribers of Tucson get Democracy Now! Cable subscribers in Phoenix do not, because Cox Cable is unwilling to carry non-commercial channels like Free Speech TV. So there's a huge battle. Arizona, you could tell me, is not the most receptive place to grassroots political organizing, as I understand, but things are changing, and I'm sure it's due to many of the change agents here in the room. So thank you for coming out today. The book, Standing Up to the Madness, it's a wonderful read. I can't recommend it enough. We have a nice incentive. If you get 2 copies today, Changing Hands will give you a free DVD, which is the 12th anniversary of our Democracy Now! It's a gala we had in late February in New York with Willie Nelson, Jackson Brown, Susan Sarandon, Dick Gregory, Danny Glover, Juan Gonzalez, I'm on it. It's a wonderful little two-hour show. Share it with people, and it's yours when you get two copies. We're going to be passing on clipboards. There's a really persistent grassroots effort to get Democracy Now! On the air in Phoenix. You probably know it. You have a monopoly of your two NPR stations. They could have the show for free on either of theirs. Apparently, they choose not to. Victor Aronow is back there with his display. They're working very hard to find, they filed two applications for full power FM licenses, which if successful would have your own community radio station, I think, cut much from the same cloth of the stations that carry Democracy Now!, the Pacifica style stations. I won't speak for that, but I can only hope that the airways will be open to shows like Democracy Now! So please find out more from Victor how you can get involved to support this important FM license application process. And as I pass around, I'll be passing around clipboards to sign up. We'll share those with Victor and his group so that their grassroots efforts are sustained by the ability to contact you. So without further ado, the co-author of Standing Up to the Madness and one of my heroes, Andy Goodman.
Thank you so much. It's very exciting to be here. To be here in Tempe, in Phoenix, to be here at the bookstore. To be here at the bookstore. And this is a special place changing hands. I mean, the fact that Gail Shanks is now going to be the head of the American Booksellers Association is really, I mean, that is the head of all the independent booksellers all over the country. These booksellers are so important, as you know, because you're here. It is a sanctuary of dissent, and we must protect these bookstores. This is our third book, Standing Up to the Madness, and we've traveled the country from one independent bookstore to another with our previous two, and all too often, when we come back for the next book, yet another bookstore has gone under. And the fact that it's not only the changing hands is here, but continues to thrive, it's because of all of you. Protect it, send your friends here, and also protect independent media, radio, and television. Democracy Now! Began 12 years ago, and I want to also thank Dennis Moynihan, who has been so instrumental in building Democracy Now!, looking forward to working with him as CEO of Free Speech TV, and I hope you do too. How many of you have satellite television? Free Speech, Dish Network?
Yeah.
Fantastic. So you know how important Free Speech TV is, Channel 9415. How did you hear about today's event? From the bookstore?
Yes.
Email list of the bookstore?
Your program today.
Today, the program? Just today? Fantastic. DirecTV, so you're watching Link TV, which is Channel 375 on DirecTV and Channel 9410 on Dish Network. Anywhere else?
Your daily email.
And I encourage folks to sign up. Dennis is sending around that clipboard with our daily digest, and it lets you know, it sends you the daily headlines, all the news stories every single day. Democracy Now! Began 12 years ago, and a couple dozen community radio stations. We're now broadcasting on over 700 stations. That's why I think... You could bring it to PBS here, NPR here. You could bring it to Public Access TV here. We are broadcasting on Pacifica stations, NPR stations, low-power FM stations, and I hope you get your own station here. College and community stations on Public Access, PBS, and the two satellite networks. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. And you can watch us, you can listen to us, and you can read the full transcripts every day of the full hour. It's a daily, grassroots, global, unembedded, Independent International News Hour.
Amy, let me just mention, my friend, this is one of his founded in the Arizona Republic.
Yeah, oh, yes. I want to thank Joe Garcia, who did the web interview with me last week, and then it was published yesterday in the Arizona Republic. And you should write letters to the editor, to the Arizona Republic, to encourage them to do conversations like this. Also, they could go a step further, because I do a weekly column. It is distributed by King Features, which they know very well. I'm sure they take some of their columnists. And no matter what the political views of the Arizona Republic, the idea of an op-ed page is to encourage dissent, discussion, debate about the most important issues of the day. We're in some of the most conservative papers in this country. The column is called Breaking the Sound Barrier. I write it, and it's a way to let people know about grassroots voices and to provide a kind of roadmap into a new universe of ideas, of independent media. It's so important we preserve the independent media spaces. The media are the most powerful institutions on Earth, more powerful than any bomb, more powerful than any missile. And the Pentagon's deployed the media, and we have to take it back. It's not good for the generals, it's not good for the low-level soldiers, and it's not good for civilian society. There is a reason why our profession, journalism, is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution, because we're supposed to be the check and balance on power. We are essential to the functioning of a democratic society. Our second book is called Static, and the reason we called it that is in this high-tech digital age with digital radio and high-definition television, all we get is ever more static. That veil of distortion and lies and misrepresentations and half-truths that obscure reality. When what we need is the media to give us the dictionary definition of static. And that's criticism, opposition, unwanted interference. We need a media that covers power, not covers for power. We need a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state. And we need a media that covers the movements that create static and make history. Talking about that column, the column we do every week, and it often involves people that we've talked to or in standing up to the madness is sort of a continuation of or a reshaping of one of the chapters we've done. Most recently, on the fifth anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, it is hard to believe the U.S. has been involved in Iraq longer than it was involved in World War II. It is hard to believe. But I did a column called Winter Soldier Marches On. How many of you heard about the Winter Soldier hearings that took place in Silver Spring at the National Labor College? Where did you hear or see? On Democracy Now. Well, it was a unique gathering. It was the eyewitness accounts of veterans and active duty soldiers. The name Winter Soldier comes from a similar event in 71 when hundreds of Vietnam vets gathered in Detroit at Howard Johnson. The name is derived from the opening line of Thomas Paine's pamphlet, The Crisis, published in 1776. He wrote, "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will in this crisis shrink from the service of their country, but he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman." Well, this Winter Soldier was sponsored by Iraq Veterans Against the War. Kelly Daugherty is its executive director. She's with the Colorado Army National Guard. She opened the proceedings by saying the voices of vets and service members as well as civilians on the ground need to be heard by the American people, by the people of the world, also by other people in the military and other vets so they can find their voice to tell their story. Because each of our individual stories is crucially important and needs to be heard if people are to understand the reality and the true human cost of war and occupation. The cost of this occupation. You heard of Joe Stiglitz, the Nobel economist, and Linda Domitz, Harvard lawyer who written the book, The $3 Trillion War, and they say that's an underestimate, $3 trillion spent in Iraq, not on Iraq, not for Iraq, and spent needing to be spent for the vets who come home, who are ailing, who are wounded. And they are the lucky ones who didn't die. Over 4,000 have in Iraq. To hear these soldiers tell their stories in the National Labor College was astounding. 4 days of gripping testimony, talking about first-hand accounts of the murder of Iraqi civilians, the dehumanization of Iraqis and Afghanis. John Michael Turner was one of those who spoke. He fought in the 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines. He tore his medals off his chest at the end of his testimony. David and I had met him a month before in Vermont. I had been invited to speak at a human rights film festival. We went to see the Valley of Elah after, and there was John. He told me about the Winter Soldier hearing, and he was in a lot of pain. He said he would be testifying there. Among the things he said, on April 18, 2006, I had my first confirmed kill. This man was innocent. I didn't know his name. I called him the Fat Man. He was walking back to his house. I shot him in front of his friend and father. He started screaming and looked right into my eyes. So I looked at my friend who I was on post with, and I said, well, I can't let that happen. So I took another shot, took him out. He was then carried away by the rest of his family. It took 7 people to carry his body away. And John went on. He said, we were all congratulated after we had our first kill, and that happened to have been mine. My company commander personally congratulated me, as he did everyone else in our company. This is the same individual who stated that whoever gets their first kill by stabbing them to death will get a 4-day pass when we return from Iraq. And then Hart Vigis spoke. He was with the 82nd Airborne, part of the invasion force of March 2003. He described a house raid where they arrested the wrong men. Hart said, we never went on a raid where we got the right house, much less the right person, not once. I looked at my sergeant, he said, and I was like, sergeant, these aren't the men we're looking for. And he told me, don't worry, I'm sure they would have done something anyways. And this mother, Hart said, all the while crying in my face, trying to kiss my feet. You know, I can't speak Arabic, but I can speak human. She was saying, please, why are you taking my sons? They've done nothing wrong, and that made me feel very powerless, he said. He said, here I was, 82nd Airborne Division, infantry, Apache helicopters, Bradley fighting vehicles, armor, my M4, and yet I was powerless. I was powerless to help this mother. Former Staff Sergeant Camilla Mejia also spoke. After serving in Iraq, he came back on leave and refused to return. He offered to testify before Congress. His unit was detaining prisoners, and he wanted to talk about the abuse. No, he didn't get to testify before Congress. They court-martialed him. And he was sentenced to close to a year in the brig, of which he served most of that time. Well, he was at Winter Soldier to speak, and at the end of his testimony, he said, we have over 1 million Iraqi dead. We have over 5 million Iraqi displaced. We have close to 4,000 dead Americans. We have close to 60,000 injured. That's not even counting the post-traumatic stress disorder and all the other psychological and emotional scars that our generation is bringing home with them. War is dehumanizing a whole new generation of this country and destroying the people in Iraq. In order for us to reclaim our humanity as a military and as a country, we demand the immediate and unconditional withdrawal of all troops from Iraq, care and benefits for all vets, reparations for the Iraqi people so they can rebuild their country on their own terms, Camilla Mejia said. As we enter the 6th year of war in Iraq, we should honor the veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, honor the people of Iraq and Afghanistan simply by listening to them. And that's why independent media is so important. Not soundbite radio or television, where you can hear an 8 or 9 second soundbite. What can you get in that amount of time? No, a media where the full discussion is fleshed out. Not a media, as we had in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq, in those 2 weeks around Colin Powell, then Secretary of State, giving his push for war at the UN. Fairness and accuracy in reporting. The Media Watch Group in New York did a study of the 4 major nightly newscasts. There were 393 interviews done in those newscasts. ABC, World News Tonight, NBC Nightly News, CBS Evening News, and the PBS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. 393 interviews done around war. In that two-week period, in the month before the invasion, so critical to you making up your minds about whether we should go to war, how many of those 393 interviews do you think were done with anti-war leaders?
None.
You are good listeners and viewers of Democracy Now. Three. I thought you were going to say zero, and I'd say that's an understatement. And I thought you were going to say four, you've overstated the case. Three of almost 400. It's no longer a mainstream media. That's an extremist media beating the drums for war. And we're seeing the same thing now with Iran. We need to have a media that tells the truth, that expresses the full diversity of opinion, because those who are opposed to war and torture are not a fringe minority, are not a silent majority, but are the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, which is why we have to take it back.
Excuse me, do you...
In standing up to the madness, we have a chapter on those soldiers who have spoken out, like Aaron Watada, Washington State, the first officer to say no to deployment, saying he would not lead young men and women into an immoral war. He's now going through the judicial system. And then you have Agustin Aguayo, Mexican-American Army medic. He said he realized in basic training he could not kill anyone under any circumstances. He applied for CO status, conscientious objector status. His evaluating officer said this guy is the real deal and recommended he get that classification. He was sent to Iraq, though, anyway. He refused to load his rifle for the full year he was there, no matter how much danger it put him in. He was denied CO status, sent back to Germany, to the base. There he went home to his wife and his two twin 11-year-old girls, and the military came for him to return him immediately to Iraq. He jumped out the back window. He went AWOL like, well, it is believed more than 10,000 soldiers have. It's the Pentagon figures, but they don't like to talk about it. He came back to the United States on Democracy Now! We interviewed him the day before he was heading to Fort Irwin to turn himself in. He said he didn't care what happened to him. He just couldn't kill anyone. And we tell his story as these soldiers stand up to the madness, ordinary heroes in extraordinary times. And then we tell the story of a group of radicals in Connecticut. You would not want to meet them in a dark alley, especially if you're violating someone's civil liberties. They are the librarians of Connecticut. It's a group of four of them who run... Are there any librarians in the house? Okay, I'm staying far from you. They run something called the Library Connection, and maybe you have it here in Arizona, something similar, but they run the library computer system. It's a small group of librarians. You know, they trade off the leadership of this group, and when Peter Chase was asked to be vice president of the group, he said, well, I have other things to do. I said, Peter, it's not going to be anything. You serve for a year. We give you this nice title. It's going to be easy. Okay, he said. He's the head of one of the libraries of Connecticut. Well, George Christian, the head of the Library Connection, gets a knock on his door. Two FBI agents are there, and they serve him with an NSL, a national security letter. There have been several hundred thousand, actually we don't really even know the exact number that he's handed out in this country. When you open such a letter, it is like being exposed to radioactivity. You cannot tell anyone that you have received this. You can't tell your family, your friends, you cannot tell your colleagues. If you speak about this letter, you could face 5 years in jail. They hand him the letter. He reads it. They're asking for information about patrons who've used the computers at a given time. He looks at them and he says, this is unconstitutional. They look at him pityingly, you know, like a predator sizing up his prey. They hand him their card. They said, you'll get back to us. And he said, we won't comply. And they said, you'll get back to us. And they left. A very brave man who then collapses in his chair, thinking, what am I going to do? Can I even call the board to tell them what has happened? Will that land me in jail? But he decides he can't do anything but that. And so he calls the three other members of the board of the Library Connection, like Peter Chase, who runs another local library. And he says, we're going to have an emergency meeting tomorrow morning. You have to show up. Don't tell anyone where you're going or what you're going to do. And Peter Chase says, what are you talking about? An emergency meeting? Like, did someone not return a book? Did someone misfile an adult book in the children's section? He said, show up. So the next morning, they get together, the four of them with their pro bono lawyer, who doesn't expect to deal with too much with these librarians. And he opens the national security letter and shows them. And then they're all exposed. None of them can reveal what they had just looked at. This is way over the head of the pro bono lawyer. And as she leaves, she says, you've got to call the ACLU. I can't deal with this. And so they call the American Civil Liberties Union. And they sued the U.S. government over the U.S. Patriot Act. It's a pretty remarkable story. They lost their names. They were called John Doe, Connecticut. They could not reveal that they were the people who'd been served with the Senate cell. This is as the renewal of the USA Patriot Act was being considered by Congress a key time to speak out. Peter Chase was head of the American Intellectual Freedom Committee of the American Library Association. He was debating everywhere very forcefully against the USA Patriot Act, against the U.S. Attorney of Connecticut, who was his opposition in the USA Patriot Act. In fact, the U.S. Attorney in Connecticut was debating on it so much he called the USA Patriot Act his mistress. And suddenly, Peter Chase had to drop out of every debate. He could no longer talk about this, because what if someone in the audience said, do you know about John Doe, Connecticut? If he said no, he would be lying. If he said yes, and they asked if he knew, he couldn't reveal he was one of them. So here was the U.S. attorney now able to push the USA Patriot Act everywhere with no opposition, because the key person, the key debater, was now silenced. Let's see, Bob has just handed me, in case of First Amendment emergency, and this is from the American Booksellers Foundation for Free Expression. If asked for customer information by a police officer, a FBI agent, or other law enforcement personnel, say, I need to talk to my attorney, and then call APFE, the American Booksellers Foundation for Free Expression. If handed a subpoena for customer information, call APFE. If presented with a search warrant for customer information, say, I need time to consult with my attorney, then call APFE. The police do not have to let you contact your attorney. If they insist on searching right away, you must let them, or you could be arrested after the police leave. Call APFE. If an FBI agent shows you a court order for records pursuant to Section 50 U.S.C. 1861 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, ask to speak to your lawyer first, and it goes on from there. USA Patriot Act has a provision that not only says librarians, but booksellers as well, have to hand over information to an FBI agent or federal authorities if they come in about patrons. And booksellers, as well as librarians, have been the major force resisting this all over the country. A major independent bookstore in Denver, Tattered Cover, also sued the government over this, refused to give over information about a book that one of the patrons had bought. So back to the librarians. They have their day in court. It's in the Bridgeport Federal Court, but they're told they're not allowed to be there. Too dangerous. They can view the proceedings from a court about 2 hours away in Hartford. They go to the court, and they're told to step into a storage closet, the four of them, where there is a closed-circuit television that shows them the proceedings of the court in Bridgeport. The security guard got very nervous. He had never locked four librarians in a storage before. They sit down. The view they have is from over the judge's shoulder, and they look out on the courtroom, and it is a heartwarming view. The courtroom is packed with librarians.
As they appeal this decision going on up, they are then allowed in the next court hearing. But they are told they're not allowed to look like librarians. I guess they have to take off their pocket protectors and forgive me. They should dress like lawyers, they were told, and not look at their lawyers. There was also another John Doe there, John Doe New York, who was a little independent internet service provider, ISP. They didn't know who he was, but he was in the courtroom. He has since written an op-ed piece in the Washington Post, but has not been able to reveal who he is. They continue to be gagged. Congress continued to debate the USA Patriot Act. The Attorney General at the time, John Ashcroft, continued to say, though calling the American Library Association a radical group, continued to say that librarians were not being served with this, and those that were could not speak out. The USA Patriot Act was passed. A few weeks afterwards, inexplicably, the gag order was lifted on these librarians, which gives you some sense of why they were gagged, not for the information they wouldn't hand over, but to stop them from testifying, because they were willing to testify anywhere they could against the violation of civil liberties. They are the only four people in this country who have been served with a national security letter and can now talk about it, and they have not stopped. They speak out all over this country to let people know what this means. These are some of the ordinary heroes in extraordinary times, our librarians now unbound. And then we talk about another sector of society, the scientists. The scientists like, well, the leading climatologist, James Hansen, head of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, well known around the world for his work on global warming. We have a chapter on some don't like it hot. And in that chapter, we were just with James Hansen on Earth Day at a big Earth Day rally in Washington, D.C. In that chapter, we talk about the 2004 presidential election approaching, something strange happening. NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, the normally steady flow of news releases about glaciers, climate change, pollution, and other earth sciences slowed to a trickle. An October 2004 news conference to present new information about ozone and air pollution from the new NASA satellite was ordered postponed until after the election. Political appointees at NASA had figured out a novel way to resolve the discrepancy between the Bush administration rhetoric and scientific reality. They would just erase our planet. All of a sudden, Earth science disappeared, said William Patzert, a NASA scientist. Earth kind of got relegated to just being one of the 9 or 10 planets. It was ludicrous. NASA's historic mission since its establishment in 1958 has been, quote, the expansion of human knowledge of the Earth and its phenomena in the atmosphere and space, which is why global warming falls squarely within the agency's purview. From 2002 to 2006, NASA's mission statement read, to understand and protect our home planet, to explore the universe and search for life, to inspire the next generation of explorers as only NASA can. Well, in early February 2006, unbeknownst to most of the agency's 19,000 employees, the mission statement was quietly changed. The phrase, to understand and protect our home planet, disappeared. Star Trek was in, planet Earth was toast. Earth had to be erased for a reason. The science about Earth, namely the alarming and incontrovertible evidence of global warming, conflicted with the fantasy being spun by President Bush and his oil industry backers that climate change wasn't really happening. My administration's climate change policy will be science-based, declared President Bush. He must have meant science fiction, because from the moment the Bush administration took power, officials set out to undermine, distort, and suppress science that didn't serve their political ideology and financial backers. As James Hansen started to put out more reports on global warming, it became clear global warming was not the problem. James Hansen was. And so they fixed a political personal minder on him, a 24-year-old named George Deutsch. college dropout, though in his resume it said he had graduated from college, his claim to fame that he had served in the war room of the 2004 Bush-Cheney re-election campaign. He would be the one who would decide who James Hansen would get to speak to, what reporters he could reveal his information to. Well, soon the scandal came out that his resume had been inflated, that in fact he hadn't graduated from college. A lot of great people haven't graduated from college, but he claimed he had on his resume, and he ultimately was forced out. And James Hansen quietly, and then not so quietly, continued to speak out on global warming. And the story is truly a remarkable one. And then we talk about the kids, the students, from the scientists, and those brave librarians to the kids. In a chapter on voices in conflict, a group in Wilson, Connecticut, high school, public high school, they're doing their annual play. Not a big deal, except for the kids who are doing the play itself. You know how these plays are. And they decide they're going to do a play on the war based on the writings home of soldiers or veterans who have come back and described their experiences. Not a huge deal. Nicely put together with their teacher. They're planning the play, they're doing the sets, they're doing their costumes, and they're learning their lines. Until the principal comes in and says, you will not be performing this play on the Winston High School stage. And they asked, why not? And he said, because it's too controversial. So word got out, the New York Times did a piece on it. And suddenly, New York theaters were calling the students, would you like to perform on the New York stage? We saw them at the Culture Project. They performed also at the New York Public Theater, and they were doing something that actors dream of all their lives, to perform on the New York stage before hundreds of theatergoers and some of the soldiers whose words they were dramatizing. It was deeply moving. We interviewed them up in Wilton after this experience. By the way, Ira Levin, the late writer, wrote a letter to the New York Times when he read the piece about the censorship. And Ira Levin is the one who wrote Stepford Wives. He grew up in Wilton. He based Stepford on Wilton. And he congratulated the kids for not being Stepfordized. So we're talking to the kids, and they told us a story. We had two of them on Democracy Now! With their teacher. And one of the young women who choreographed the show said, right after our broadcast on Democracy Now!, and it was the summer, she got a call. Her sister was downstairs, answered the phone, and said, yeah, it's for you. It's your teacher. And that's surprising for a kid in the summer getting a call from their teacher. And she gets on the phone. It's Mr. So-and-so. And he's furious at her. And he says, how dare you not challenge Jimmy on Democracy Now! When he said he couldn't talk about war in school. Of course he can. You know he can in our class. And she was so amazed, first of all, that he was calling the teacher. And she said, oh, my God, I mean, I went on that show, Democracy Now!, it was me and Jenny and the teacher. And she said, all of a sudden, the lights went on, and we were asked questions. I can't even remember what she asked, and then the show was over. And she said, you wanted me to correct Jimmy? And she said, well, wait a second. See, Jimmy had told us that when I asked him if he can discuss war in school, they said they have their political science class, and every week each one brings in a current event, but they're not allowed to discuss war. He said, actually, we can also talk about it in Middle East Studies class, but they weren't offering it that year. And so the only class was drama, but they could talk about the war. And as this young student got her wits about her talking to her teacher, she said she realized what he was talking about. And she said, wait, you mean we can talk about it in your class when you bring in the recruiter? So the students and the scientists, the librarians and soldiers, and then there's the psychologists. How many of you are psychologists? Or no one? Well, there's a very interesting debate going on within the largest association of psychologists in the world, the American Psychological Association. I wrote my column on it a few weeks ago. Maybe soon you'll be reading it in the Arizona Republic. Called the anti-torture president. Imagine a candidate for president, and this is based on our chapter in the book, Psychologists in Denial. Imagine a candidate for president who a year or so ago no one would have considered electable. Now the person is a frontrunner with a groundswell of grassroots support threatening the sense of inevitability of the establishment candidate. No, I'm not talking about the U.S. presidential race, but the race for president, the largest American, the largest association of psychologists in the world, the APA. At the heart of the election is a raging debate over torture and interrogations, while the other healing professions, the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric Association, bar their members from participating in interrogations, the APA leadership has fought such a restriction. Frustrated with the APA, an New York psychoanalyst named Dr. Steve Reisner has thrown his hat in the ring. Last year, Reisner and other dissident psychologists formed the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology in an attempt to force a moratorium against participation by APA members in harsh interrogations. During the initial phase of this year's presidential selection process, Reisner received the most nominating votes. He is running on a platform opposing the use of psychologists to oversee abusive and coercive interrogations of prisoners at Guantanamo, at CIA secret black sites, or anywhere else international law or the Geneva Conventions are said not to apply. Well, the issue came to a head this last August in San Francisco. Democracy Now! Headed out to cover the convention of the APA. Who would have thought it would have been as dramatic and riveting as it was? After days of late-night negotiations, the moratorium came up for a climactic vote. We saw a surreal scene on the convention floor. Uniformed military were out in force. Men and women in desert camo and navy whites worked. The APA Council of Representatives and officers in crisp dress uniforms stepped to the microphones. Now see, the APA is made up of about 148,000 psychologists. Most don't get involved with the psychologists associations. So you join to get your insurance, basically. But then they're starting to hear about all this. Why all these psychologists in full military regalia? Well, there's a small group of about 1,000 military psychologists, but they have a disproportionate power within the association. They head up a number of the divisions of the 50 divisions of the APA. Military psychologists insisted they help make interrogation safe, ethical, and legal, and cited instances where psychologists allegedly intervened to stop abuse. Colonel Larry James came up to the microphone. He is with the U.S. Army, chief psychologist at Guantanamo Bay, member of the APA governing body. He was flown up from Guantanamo to fight the moratorium. He boomed into the microphone, "If we remove psychologists from these facilities, people are going to die." Who runs these facilities? The U.S. government, the U.S. military. So Dr. Lori Wagner, a Donald psychologist, shot back, "If psychologists have to be there in order to keep detainees from being killed, then those conditions are so horrendous that the only moral and ethical thing to do is to protest by leaving," she said. With that, the moratorium failed. Immediately after the vote, Dr. Reisner got up at a packed town hall meeting that was sponsored by the APA. The leadership sponsored this. You wonder why it wasn't sponsored before the vote. But they understood the need for the psychologists to vet. They were psychologists, after all. And they knew there was this growing dissident movement, and they had to deal with it somehow. So Dr. Reisner got up and he said, "If we cannot say no, we will not participate in enhanced interrogations at CIA black sites, I think we have to seriously question what we are as an organization, and for me, what my allegiance is to this organization, or whether we might have to criticize it from outside the organization." I recorded this on the camera at the open town hall meeting, but almost didn't get to do that because there were hundreds of psychologists there. It was an open town hall meeting. The APA leadership got up, welcomed people, said we encourage debate. We were able to record all of that. And then when we continued recording, they came up to me in the back and they said, "You will turn off your camera now. Your 10 minutes are up." I said, "Why, is the meeting over?" "No, but your 10 minutes are up." "Well, why 10 minutes? Your 10 minutes are up." And they said they would call security if I didn't turn off the camera. I said, "You're just going to have to call security then." So it was an open mic, so I came up to the mic and I asked the psychologist, because the APA said this was a democratic process and they wanted people to be able to speak, I said, "Do you want us to turn off the camera?" And, of course, they got very angry and raucous, and they started to shout, and the leadership started to try to justify themselves. They called the communications director of the APA. She came running in from another meeting, barreling down the aisle, takes the microphone and said, "Let me explain why it is we said turn off the camera. Yes, this is an open session, but we thought it was only fair that the camera be turned off after 10 minutes because we want to rotate in the press. Make sure there was room for everyone to record." And everyone's looking around, what press? So we recorded the whole session. And we broadcast it. Reisner and others began withholding dues. Prominent APA members resigned. The best-selling author of Reviving Ophelia, Mary Piper from Lincoln, Nebraska, returned her APA presidential citation after hearing the debate on Democracy Now! When I asked Dr. Reisner just recently, the son of Holocaust survivors, why he would want to head the organization that he's battled for years, he said, "If I have this opportunity to make a change, I have a responsibility to do it. I never had the intention of being involved, but the only way to ensure this be changed is by claiming the democratic process in the name of human rights." And he went on. You know, things with the papers get a little tangled when I'm traveling on plane after plane. But I want to quote him exactly. He went on to say, he went on to say that he thought it was his personal responsibility if he could work within the association. He said that America should not represent torture, that we are better than that. Well, the Boston, the next meeting of the APA, the annual convention, is in August in Boston. Surely this will be a key debate. In October, the psychologists will begin their voting for the next president of the American Psychological Association. The results will come out at about the same time as the election of president of the United States. Let's just hope in both cases that torture is a central debate that takes place. You know the famous quote of Mahatma Gandhi, "We begin standing up to the madness with it." First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. I want to end by talking about the turning points in history. We intersperse what is happening today with turning points in history, like the Soweto uprising and the kids in 1976 taking on the apartheid regime, or Dan Ellsberg in the Pentagon Papers, the middle of the Vietnam War. He's a high-level Pentagon official, works for the RAND Corporation, has top security clearance, is looking outside at all of these protesters. And behind him is a vault. It is filled with thousands of pages of the secret history of U.S. involvement in Vietnam, and he has the key to the vault, or the combination. He decides to open it, Xerox those pages, and have them published in the New York Times. He knows he faces the rest of his life in jail for treason. But if he said, if he could help to end the Vietnam War, it was his moral responsibility to do it. Even if he's been claimed a hero by so many, he still has tremendous regret today, he said, that he didn't do it sooner. And we begin the book with another story, and this is where I'll end. It's the story of Rosa Parks. Now, you might say, why tell that story again? It's one story we all know. Rosa Parks, December 1st, 1955, sits down on the bus in Montgomery, Alabama, and refuses to get up for a white passenger when the bus driver says, "Go to the back of the bus." And in so doing, she stands up not only for African Americans, but for all of us, because if one of us is diminished, we are all diminished. We know that story. Well, last year she died. She was the first African American woman to lay in state in the Capitol Rotunda. Democracy Now! Raced to Washington for the big service in the Washington Church before the funeral in Detroit. Thousands turned out, Oprah Winfrey, Cicely Tyson inside, and thousands outside, and it's often more interesting to be outside. We interviewed a freshman, a woman in college, who said she emailed her professor that day and said, "I won't be in class, I'm going to get an education." And I interviewed an old woman by the side of the road. She was listening intensely to the loudspeaker. She was 91 years old. And she said she had sat down on the bus 14 years before Rosa, not in the South, in the North, in Massachusetts. She clutched her book, pretending she was reading when the bus driver said, get to the back of the bus, and she refused. Other women in Montgomery, Alabama had sat down on the bus before Rosa. In fact, Rosa herself had sat down before Rosa, December 1st, 1955. But this was the moment. This was the turning point. You can never predict when that will be. But you can help to lay the foundation when that moment comes, to help guide the direction the change will take. That's why this year is so important. This is an election year, 2008, that could be the most important year of our lives. It really matters that you are involved for yourselves, for your community, for people in this country, and for people all over the world. We come from the most powerful country on earth. What we do matters. Has a ripple effect all over the world. Years ago, I interviewed a woman from Guyana on globalization. And then at the break, we play music, and we switch out our guests. And sometimes we play the music a little longer. It's not just because we like the music, but, you know, maybe someone trips or they know someone has to get their mic on. And I am ushering this woman out to bring in a new group of guests to talk about the U.S. elections. And the woman from Guyana is just sitting there. I said, actually, the segment is over. And she said, well, I will stay and be a part of this discussion. And I said, on the U.S. elections? And she said, yes. And I said, why? You're from Guyana. And she said, because I believe everyone in the world should get to vote for President of the United States. Now, this is a very profound. Think about it. Well, she doesn't get to vote, and you all do. It does matter. It is the most powerful position on earth. But there is a force more powerful, and it is all of you. And if you don't like the top candidates who are running, get involved at the lower level yourselves, or support people who do want to be involved in the political process, whether it's at the school board level or the library board or the city council or the state legislature. And pretty soon, you're going to be finding you do agree with the top presidential candidates in the years to come. You don't have to agree with everything this year. But you have to be involved. We have got to turn this country around. How is it possible we have come to represent torture around the world? America is better than that. Back to Rosa. December 1st, 55, she sits down on the bus. We all know the story. So how did the corporate media get it wrong once again? Well, they said Rosa Parks was a tired teamstress. She was no troublemaker. That's where they got it wrong. She was a first-class troublemaker. Rosa Parks was the local secretary of the NAACP of Montgomery, worked with E.D. Nixon. He was president of the NAACP. He came out of radical labor politics. Together, they were challenging the segregation laws for years. She trained at the Highlander Center in Tennessee, black and white together, challenging injustice. She'd sat down on the bus before. She had been planning this very carefully. She was an activist. The media denigrates activists, but what could be more noble than dedicating your life to making the world a better place? That night, her friend Joanne Robinson, educator, activist, mimeographed 35,000 leaflets to start to spread the word that the Montgomery bus system should be boycotted until they're integrated. A few days later, December 5th, 1955, the Montgomery Improvement Association mass meeting took place. They chose as their leader, as their spokesperson, to push this boycott forward, a young minister who just come to town, Dr. Martin Luther King. Rosa Parks helped to launch Dr. Martin Luther King. Within a year, segregation in the buses of Montgomery would be over. The Supreme Court struck down those laws. And to show how brave Rosa was, go back a few months, summer of 55, Emmett Till. Little boy, 14 years old, mom sends him down to Money, Mississippi to be with family for the summer. He's lynched by some white men. Not even clear to this day exactly what happened. He ends up in the bottom of the Tallahatchie River. They said he wolf whistled at a white woman. When his body was sent back to Chicago, his mother, Mamie Till, did something incredibly brave. She said she wanted the casket open for the wake and funeral. She wanted the world to see the ravages of racism, the brutality of bigotry. thousands streamed by and saw, and then Jet Magazine and other black publications published the images of Emmett's head. And they were seared into the consciousness and history of this country. Mamie Till Mobley has something very important to teach the press of today. Show the pictures. Show the images. Could you imagine if for just 1 week we saw the images of war in Iraq? We saw the babies dead on the ground. We saw the soldiers dead and dying. We saw the women with their legs blown off by cluster bombs. For just 1 week. Americans are a compassionate people. They would say, no, war is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. Democracy Now!